This is The Guardian.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Will party holidays live on forever?
So today is DLT day, finally.
The garage scene here is so interesting at the moment because you've got like all your London club promoters coming over with their club night.
Napa, no, what's Napa saying this year?
Napa is massive. The people who are in London, they're not even ready, they don't know.
You're listening to Pop Culture with me, Shantae Joseph, for The Guardian. There is a long history of going on party holidays in my family. Before I was born, my dad went to the first Innovation in the Sun and ended up DJing there. My aunties and cousins used to go to Ayia Napa and they would come back with some amazing stories. For me, I've been going to events like Recess, Danky and DLT for years. And these events, many of them having started as small Black day parties, have started to expand into huge party holidays. So why are party holidays so important?
This one, I'm like, yo, I'm in The Guardian, bro. Yeah. This one is going on a newspaper.
Jeez, I quite like The Guardian is my favorite publication.
Anne and MK are the founders of DLT, Days Like This. They're taking the party to Malta this week, and by the time you're listening to this podcast, I'll be living my best life there. So how did the boys start this party?
DLT, I'll say it started off as a day party, but I kind of think we see it as, it's a bit more than that now. It's a bit of like a movement now. We're trying to be involved in everything. Me and my friends, we all lived in New York. We did an internship in finance, funny enough. We were all living out there. We never went to work. And all we did was party. And we're looking at the parties. We're like, wow, why are we partying so much? Like, we don't party this much in London. Like, what's the difference? And we realized that a lot of the parties that we went to, people literally dressed how they wanted. They embraced Black culture, embraced Black music. And it was like a breath of fresh air for us. And we were like, we can bring this to London. We can bring this kind of like movement and vibe into London. And when we moved back, we're like, do you know what, guys? Let's try it. Started off with 200 people. 200? 250?
300.
Literally begging all our friends, buy your tickets.
Tickets were £5. Like, please buy a ticket.
Yeah. And it just went on from then. It just went from strength to strength. And now we've got Malta. We're doing festivals. We're booking our favourite artists and stuff like that, which is it's a bit surreal for us. Yeah.
No, it's amazing. And can you paint me a bit of a picture of your like early clubbing days? Like, do you remember the first time you went out like properly clubbing? What was that like for you? What were your experiences like?
My first early clubbing experience, I went out with my older brothers. I got two older brothers and I think it was somewhere in East Central, maybe Old Kent Road. I can't remember. But I just remember we had to dress up, I had to wear a belt. Like, do you know what I mean? My brother brought me his belt, he brought me his shoes. And he's like, no, we've got to look smart. We're not going to get in. So from early, that's always been imprinted in my brain that when you're going out at night in London, you got to come smart.
You kind of said in previous interviews that you wanted to create a space with DLT where people can dress the way they want. And obviously you talk about your early experiences of going out and being told you have to dress up smart. And I'll never forget that day on Twitter where everyone was like posting their pictures of like wearing blazers in the club.
100%. And now I was that guy.
And people were wearing like blazers. The girls were wearing like peplum skirts. It was literally giving office wear to the club.
So, yeah.
And I think I kind of outside of that idea of like restrictions on the way you dressed, were there any other things about like nightlife that you found quite...
I think it was one of those things where you didn't feel that welcome. I mean, getting turned away from a night out was normal. Like, yeah. For a guy.
It's lucky
like,
dip, isn't it?
It's like, guys, we're going here tonight, but let's arrive at 9. Let's go in separate groups. So bare times you wouldn't get in. And then sometimes it's like you get in and you'd wait for an hour of music you recognised. Other than that, it's just once music all night. I guess when we came back, I think we went out. We were trying to go out. Like, you know, so coming back from New York, we're still trying to go out as much as we did in New York, but we're just realising that there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere that's catered for us. You know, whatever. Let's just create our own night with our friends. Even if it doesn't go well, like, whatever. It's our music. It's our mates. We've done something. And then we later realised that we weren't the only ones who had that frustration or felt that gap. Anything we do now, it's like, this is a space for, like, Black people to enjoy themselves and be themselves.
In terms of its growth, obviously you started, you said there were like between 200 to 300 people, and now you've kind of gone on to do international events, like huge events, festivals. And so why do you think it has just grown in the way that it has?
I think like Black people kind of just said, hey, we also want to do our own thing. Like we're tired of going to these things that aren't for us. And I think, you know, when that whole kind of George Floyd thing happened, people have intentionally like, actually, I want to put my coin behind that. And I think like that was also kind of translated into nightlife. It's like,
yes,
I want to go to a Black event where the music's created for me, where the food is for me, where the people are like me, and where the experience is what I want. You're in a Black space.
And what made you bring the event internationally? Like, how did you start to say, do you know what? London is great. We're doing great events in London. Now we're going to go to Lagos. Now we're going to go to Malta.
We wanted to connect with the diaspora. And I think we wanted to show the rest of the diaspora what Black British culture looks like. But also there's more stories to it, like that than Top Boy.
Oh, do you mean like Black British people?
Black British people are more than what you see on Top Boy. Right? Yeah. There's a joy side of it. Do you know what I mean?
And we're cool.
So we kind of thought like, you know what? London's sick, but we want to connect with the rest of the Black diaspora. And also we want to learn from them as well. Do you know what I mean? When we go over to Africa or New York or a Toronto, like we want to see what's popping on that side so we can also enhance what we're doing on this side.
Do you have any crazy like stories, like near misses with events or artists? Like, give me all of the tea.
Artist
stories are funny because they're the hardest part of it. Like, we had no clue how to book artists before. Like, we just literally just thought like, oh yeah, you just speak to the manager and all that stuff, but there's just so much things to do and there's like etiquette towards it. And I think the biggest lesson that we learned is that we never knew that when you email an agent and be like, hey, we want to book this person, you send an offer, and if they say accepted, it means they are locked in and you have to pay them and you have to, and you have
to just turn around and be like,
no, we don't want to do it no more. And we did that bare.
So like, we've got a few agents that don't like
us. Yeah, but I don't know, we changed our mind. We don't have enough money. And then we did that bare. And I think we learned that really quickly and the hard way.
Remember the first time when we saw Ryder? I was like, what's that?
Yeah. Yeah, we saw Ryder.
What's a Ryder for people who don't know what it is?
It's just an artist.
It's a tech rider and a hospitality rider.
So hospitality is like drinks, food, towels, refreshments, all that kind of stuff. So when we first saw that, I was like, is this what people request?
Yeah.
We're like, I said, how do you afford this?
No, but you were even annoyed. Like, why are they requesting so much things? Like,
what's that? Where do you get the money to pay for this?
What sort of stuff are artists asking for?
Oh my God.
They always ask for towels. That's like towels, the number one thing they ask for.
About 16 bottles of drink that they're never going to drink.
Drink, yeah.
And bringing it back to the UK, like, Black club culture has always been quite a political space, like both the events, the music, and the individuals that party themselves. So from 2005 to 2017, there was this risk assessment form called Form 696, and the Met Police used it to shut down parties. And one of the criticisms of the form was that it was kind of, it racially profiled certain nightclubs or certain events because there was a line in the form that said, you know, is there a particular ethnic group attending? If yes, please state this group. It's really interesting to kind of see how, as just Black people who want to experience joy, like we're essentially criminalized for that, for wanting to gather, for wanting to enjoy music. And do you think, as people who put on events now, do you think those who are operating under a time in which 696 existed, do you think they felt that it was, like, they felt put off from putting on events? You think that stifled Black nightlife?
I think so. I 100% think so. I think even sometimes when we first started out, our first opportunity to use or hire a venue, I feel like at the time, it was in 2016, I feel like if it wasn't a Black owner, it probably wouldn't have happened.
We used to email venues off our corporate emails. So we all worked in banks at the time. So we'd email via HSBC or whatever. So it looked like it's going to be like a corporate event. But actually, hold on, we're actually going to throw a party for a bunch of black people.
Yeah.
And then it used to be like, oh shit, like they've been hoodwinked. They can't go back now. But because they thought it was like, we were like people in this banking space that was trying to throw like an event. They thought they saw money, but we had to like kind of trick them because they didn't really want us. And then I think it was really hard for us to kind of like get over that.
But, and it took a while to understand their perspective because it's a licensing risk, like you've just mentioned, right? Because they've got the pressures coming from the police. And I guess if anything happens, they're like, oh, licensing. But it's like, black people are not scary, man. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, we're going to come, have a good time. We'll be gone by 10 o'clock.
When you speak to a bunch of like the people that did it before us, I think they're like, oh, wow, why did we never think of doing it in the daytime? And I feel like because we were doing it in the daytime, we're afforded a little bit of leeway when all the 696 stuff happened, I think, because it was nighttime and it was a bunch of black people. They were like, ah, okay, cool, this is not happening. This is going to cause trouble. I feel bad at the same time because it's a bit like
they paved the way
for us, because when you like read back on stuff like what happened with So Solid and stuff like that and all those guys and how all their stuff used to get locked off. Like, if that happened to us, we'd actually cry.
In the middle of the dance, the police are like, wrap it up. I'm like, sorry?
It's crazy.
You have to arrest me.
Yeah. It's so crazy when you think about it. Like, imagine the middle DLT police just come in and just like, lock off the dance. And there's 1,500 people inside. And you're just like, huh? Do you know what I mean? It's mad.
It's actually crazy. But it's like, it's good, though, that you kind of have the space you have now and like the people that came before you. But it's really interesting to see that you kind of opted more towards the day party in order to avoid that, I guess, harassment or pushback.
Yeah, and it was very intentional with the day parties, and it made a lot of conversations easier as well.
They don't make money in the days.
There's no day trade for bars and restaurants, and so it's like, oh, you can get this many people here at this time, and you'll be out by when. So it made that conversation a little easier.
Yeah. And so when I think about, I guess, the history of like black music and culture and black parties, I think about places like Ayanapa. And before we were recording this podcast, I was talking about how like the sort of like black British party holiday has felt like such a rite of passage into adulthood for like everyone in my family almost. Because I called my dad earlier today, and my dad was like really big in the drum and bass scene. He used to put on his own drum and bass nights. He used to DJ international drum and bass nights. And he went to the first, I think it's called like Intermission. He was a huge like holiday party that happened in Spain. It was a big drum and bass thing. And he was like, I went to the very first one in 1995 with all of my friends. And then my aunts and my cousin, who is like maybe in her mid to late, well, in their mid 30s, they used to go to Ayanapa and Malia and do that stuff. And, you know, my generation or just me, I'm going to, you know, DLT Malta. So it's always been a huge kind of part of like black British like culture and party going. But do you think that sort of early Ayanapa scene and how influential UK garage was there helped to pave the way for what you guys are doing today?
100%. So I'm about sure my age, because I used to go Malia and Napa. So we might be homies. So yeah, I did Napa, I did Malia, I did Ibiza. And like you said, those things, they were crazy, because it's like, I was so young then. Like, so I'm thinking, rah, like, this is sick. Look at all the people that I know, plus all these other black people that I don't know. And we're on this island, and it feels like we're the only one on the island, and we're all going to the same raves, we're all going to the same beach parties, we're getting quad bikes. It was just insane. And it's like, it definitely paved the way for like, for me anyway, in terms of like putting together a motor. It's like, okay, I know what this feels like. I know what my first experience of a black party holiday was like, and I know what I want people to feel. 100% paved the way. For me, I just remember coming back on that holiday like, yo, that was sick. And you felt free as well. So, and it's that freedom and that joy that we want to keep.
Let's take a minute, party people, and when we come back, we'll hear about how Ayanapa became a world-famous party island.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back, ravers. Ayanapa was a huge moment in the history of party holidays. In the mid-1990s, garage nights in the UK were exploding. Two club nights dominated the scene, Pure Silk and Twice as Nice.
Welcome aboard, all listeners. Welcome aboard, all ravers. This is the Pure Silk Ayanapa album 2000.
By 1999, both nights were out in Ayanapa, and each summer, the UK garage scene would decamp to this tiny Cypriot island. And for almost a decade, it was the place to be.
So forget Ibiza, this year it's Ayanapa.
But with every rise comes a fall. After a series of violent incidents, the island's reputation got worse and garage was eventually banned.
The legacy of Ayanapa will always be the garage. And Ayanapa is something that we created that would have been from our culture, where we were at the helm of this.
DJ S is the founder of Pure Silk, the first UK garage night to go to Ayanapa. We started with where it all began for him.
As a young kid, I used to listen in the 80s, listen to Lock Into All the Pirates. I just loved the whole acid house explosion, and it just progressed from there, really. I used to buy records every Sunday, started going to the raves, Biology, Sunrise, Genesis. Then it progressed into the hardcore, the Living Dreams, the Elevations, and so just a raver, really. I suppose that was the whole apprenticeship of trying to be a DJ, but trying to actually be a DJ was very difficult in those days.
What were some of the challenges?
I'm Asian, so there was no Asians in the game. And it's, even up until today, it's very, very few.
Mm.
How I did become a DJ was eventually when I started Pure Silk. So that's obviously my own platform now. It was probably the easiest way of doing it, but prior to that, very difficult.
I want to kind of get into the music, so specifically garage music. In the mid-1990s, it really started to take off in the UK. And can you kind of take us back to that time, like being in the centre of it all? What was it like?
I'd say probably one of the first pivotal nights was Sunday night at the Gas Club. And you'd have Daryl B, Norris the Boss, Creed, Dominic Spreadlove. And this was the real first root of the scene in London.
DJ Dominic on the decks. Welcome to Spread Love, each and every Sunday night at the Gas.
This started a culture. Every Sunday is the part, major part of the history. This was around the 95 period. And then early 97, January, we started as Pure Silk.
And so whilst you were kind of putting on these nights, this UK garage light was basically dominating the club scene. But we know that from 2005, the Met Police used the 696 form, which basically made it a lot harder for people to put on specific nights. What do you remember about that time, specifically Form 696?
There was a lot of problems at that moment. Garage, from 97, 96, 97, 98, 99, was full of posers, Gucci loafers, which in a rave, where I come from, you didn't go out to rave like this. So it's full of posers. So you'd have like the gangsters, young gangsters who want to be gangsters, who are just making so much money coming, going to the bar and not, oh, can I have a drink? It's a buying a crate of champagne sort of thing. And as it progressed, when something's hype, it just attracts people. Then it attracts the little gangs, and you've got the biggest party at the time, and everyone wants to be there. They know all the girls are going to be there. The way people dressed and come out to a garage event was unbelievable. It was, you know, the footballers were in our events.
Who was the most famous one?
So we used to have Rio Ferdinand. He was,
you know,
we had loads of.
He was raving to garage in the clubs.
Rio, yeah.
And so with all of, kind of you saying there's this whole thing of all these different gangs, do you think it was bad enough for these forms to come in and stifle the scene?
I can understand the police's concerns, but the police needed to do more in terms of doing their job rather than now coming to do a 696 form.
Because I think, like, the violence is not something that's unique to that specific scene or that specific music. It kind of happens everywhere. But it does feel like a lot of the targeting was quite racialized because, you know, 6ix9ine Form asked for, you know, what's the ethnicity of the party goers? Who are the MCs? What kind of music is it? And so it was very much trying to pick up on things, asking about race without really asking about race. So you had a, so they had an excuse to be like,
ultimately,
you know, this can't happen.
That's what it came down to in the end, just like basically ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
So, which then we couldn't do no more events in London. There were one or two garages which were very white, cheesy, fluffy, were allowed to, but we couldn't.
Mm.
They completely closed us down. It affected a lot of people in our game. It was really financially.
Yeah.
Because now as a DJ, as a promoter, record, everything is the ripple effects of everything. Record labels to a major collapse. I just felt the police, they didn't handle it the right way. We became the scapegoat.
Yeah, it's sad that over-policing has kind of like led to this whole incredible like thriving scene being like basically squashed because of racism. I want to kind of get into the Iron Upper side of things now, because I'm really, really interested in this. Like, growing up, I would kind of see my cousins, you know, my aunts, like, going abroad to Iron Upper to go to these parties. It was like, it was a huge thing for them. And you would kind of hear it even in the mixes they were listening to. They would come back and they'd be playing the songs or they'd be talking about their time there. And I kind of started to view it as a bit of like a kind of rite of passage into like, essentially like Black British adulthood, because it was like what all of the older people around me were doing. And so in 1998, it's kind of a year after Pure Silk was launched and it was drawing huge crowds in London. But what made you want to take it to Iron Upper? How did that even come about?
So the Malas family, who are the family of the island, they had a venue called the Pizzazz Club, which was their biggest venue, capacity of around 2,000 people. Tony, who was their general manager of the company, got a message to me. I had to go and meet him. So I went there and saw him. He said, look, I've seen what you're doing and everything. I'd like you to come and play here. The head of the family, he called a meeting with me at the radio station. They had Napa Radio. He said, look, guys, I said, yeah, I'm interested in doing this venue. I think if we go back to the UK and put a campaign behind this, I think we could bring people over and really make an impact next year. And I think the club's great. And he said, yeah, no, I think so as well. He said, if we're going to start this, we're going to start this next Friday. Yeah, so this first night, Spoonie, me and Creed, we attracted about 1,000 people. The music was growing. Everything was, it was the right moment. You know, sometimes things have got to happen at the right moment. And so 1999, it was just 2,000 people every week, every Friday in Pizzazz Club. And then we had a lot of the press contact us. So MTV, Radio 1, and these sort of people went to get behind us.
Yeah.
And expose the island a little bit.
And it's incredible because then it just became a huge part of like British culture. Do you know what I mean? Like Iron Upper is just something that is a staple to so many people. And like everyone's kind of familiar with it. They're familiar with the music. They're familiar with the videos, the culture around it. And like you said, the press, there was a lot of press coming. And it's obviously because, you know, huge people themselves were coming over. The music was blowing up. But then it also came with the sort of violence. Do you remember much of that in your time?
That wasn't there in the first few years. First biggest press that came was from a MTV party on the beach with Trevor Nelson. There was a big stabbing and it was all over the news. I was in the UK for that week, so I flew back the next week and thinking, wow, can't believe how big this news is.
Mm.
Why has it blown up like this? That was 2000. So 99, 2000, 2001, they were thriving years. Even though you had that incident of Trevor Nelson and I think come 2001, I think you had the music was changing where more younger MCs groups were forming, wanted to use the garage scene as a platform for them to expose themselves and go on to become artists. So we had obviously that Soul Solid Crew. And these are guys who'd come to Iron Upper who have never been on holiday before.
Mm.
They're coming, they're earning money.
Mm.
You know, I understood it, to be fair. So you had these groups come along, pay as you go, and Dizzy Rascal. So this, the music was changing.
In 2003, when Dizzy Rascal was there, he was stabbed, and that kind of made a bit of like a dent. You know, a lot of people were talking about it. He was like kind of somewhat of a big artist at the time. A lot of younger people looked up to him. A lot of young people enjoyed his music. And that was kind of like a bit of a pivotal moment. And then, you know, after all of that, the mayor then banned Garage being played in the clubs for 2 years. And do you think that kind of, I guess, started the demise of the scene or even of iNapa being a place where people go to listen to this music?
We felt as urban, whatever you want to call us, we never had what Judge Jules had in Ibiza, or what Paul Oakenfold had, and what Carl Cox had. It was Ibiza, but it wasn't ours. In iNapa, we're the stars. So when they're coming to play, they're not the stars. So they would be playing in the Castle Club, Paul Oakenfold, but they're not the stars. We're the stars now. Yeah, I think this is where the racial thing starts. It's non-white.
Yeah.
It's more of a story for them. It went from positive to negative press.
Yeah.
And that didn't help.
And so how did all of these incidents end up affecting Pure Silk?
What we didn't like was the music had changed, the crowd had changed. We wasn't enjoying it no more.
Yeah.
We had like, then you had more crews, like Nasty Crew, like with Kano. And in the end, we could feel the numbers of the island decreasing. It wasn't the same no more. I think the press had hurt it. The publicity wasn't good. So the numbers in generally wasn't the place to come no more.
It's interesting because I can't think of anything that really replaced iNapa. It was kind of, it was there and then afterwards it wasn't. I mean, I know Ibiza is still there, but I just feel like iNapa was so distinctively different. Like it provided something very different that I don't think has really been replicated.
It hasn't. I've never been one to draw the race card. I've never, because I've always, I understand society, so I'm going to sit and start. Because I've always got through, there's always opportunities for me. But I always wondered, was it a case of this was somewhere for like the urban people, which I always felt there's a racial something, because never had a destination popped up where it rivaled Ibiza, and still till today it hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
You said about Malta and everything, but nothing's rivaled anything. And I always wondered, was there some sort of narrative from the press to really... You see it with the footballers somewhere, sometimes, you know. A white player does it, when a black player does the same thing, it's really, there's a narrative. Did they want to kill it off? I always felt there was something behind it.
I don't think it is a reach to say that Black Joy is really criminalised. And we see this in the way it's over-policed. We know this from Form 696, from the way that a whole genre was basically squashed because of bad press and policing. I think it's so important to cultivate spaces for Black Joy because, yes, these people are putting on an event, but we know it's so much more than that. So we should support and we should attend and we should shout about all of the amazing things these event promoters are doing. That's all, party people. I hope you enjoyed what you heard. And listen, if you loved it, then subscribe and leave me a review. This week's episode was produced by Hattie Moya, sound design by Mao Lasseto, original music by Axel Caputier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. See you next Thursday.
This is The Guardian.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.